As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
This is The Athletic Baseball Show on The Athletic Podcast Network.
Welcome to the Athletic Baseball Show, presented by Topps. Check out Topps Project 70, celebrating 70 years of Topps baseball cards. Happy Monday, everyone. As you start your week, wherever you're heading, just remember to always step on first base, unlike Ke'Bryan Hayes last week. I'm Tim McMaster, along with Ken Rosenthal, who is here to answer all of your baseball questions in our Monday mailbag. Ken, how you doing?
I'm doing well, Tim. How are you?
I am good, and I think we're both doing better than the Yankees right now, who continue to struggle. 33-32 on the season. They lost two straight to the Phillies this weekend. They've lost 7 of 9 overall. What is going on in the Bronx, Ken?
Tim, that's a great question, and I wrote about the Yankees last Monday coming out of the series at Yankee Stadium where they were swept by the Red Sox, and I basically got into three different people. The owner, Hal Steinbrenner, the general manager, Brian Cashman, and the manager, Aaron Boone. And basically what I said was this starts at the top. There is a lack of urgency reflected by their reluctance, if not outright refusal, to go over the luxury tax threshold. That's ownership's call, and it's kind of limited them in recent years. Obviously, Tampa Bay does a lot more with less, and I get that, but they're the New York Yankees. And I know there was a pandemic, but the pandemic was not going to be permanent. And guess what? Things are coming back, and the sport is coming back financially. And then I got into the roster construction, and obviously it's flawed. We know that there are players out of position. It is not a particularly athletic group, and that's putting it kindly. And then finally, I talked about the manager, Aaron Boone. And Aaron Boone was outmanaged by Alex Cora last weekend. I don't know that anyone would question that. The Yankees lead the world in outs on the bases. They're not a good defensive team. They're 19th in outs above average, 22nd in defensive runs saved. And when you're not scoring, and they're not scoring, they're 26th in majors, 26th in runs per game, then all of these deficiencies get magnified. So then came Sunday and Boone's postgame presser. And let's take a listen to how he handled this question and just the exchange he had with MLB.com's reporter Brian Hoke.
Do you sense there's a fatigue in the dugout, maybe a complacency as these losses pile up where guys are just almost getting used to losing here?
No.
Why not?
I know them too well, and I don't think there's any getting used to freaking losing. Hell no. Get the hell out of here with that.
So there you heard it, and if you saw it, if you saw the look on Boone's face as he answered that question, it was frankly disturbing. And David Sampson, the former president of the Marlins, who has a podcast and is very active on Twitter, tweeted after that, "This is the exact kind of interview that precedes a managerial change." And I will say this, as someone who has covered the sport for almost 35 years, that look where you look like you're under a siege mentality, yes, that is the look of a manager who is kind of out of answers. Now, was the question aggressive? Yes, it was aggressive, maybe even too aggressive. I'm not sure I would have worded it the same way, but you know what? Aaron Boone works in New York. He understands how it works. He's got to answer the question, in my view, in a little bit different way. And my concern here is that once you reach this point with a manager, once he gets to this point, and I'm not saying he's like this with the players. I don't know how he is with the players right now. But to see that tenseness, to see the edge there, and not in a good way, that makes me wonder if he is going to last the season. The problem for the Yankees is they don't have an obvious internal candidate. Carlos Mendoza, their bench coach, is widely viewed as a managerial candidate going forward, but he has not managed before in the big leagues, and that would be a stretch to imagine him suddenly taking over and leading this team to the postseason. People are going to ask about Buck Showalter, the former Yankees manager, very successful with the Yankees, with Texas to some degree, with the Orioles certainly, but I don't know that Brian Cashman wants someone like Buck Showalter. The key word now is collaboration. Not saying that Buck can't collaborate, but this is how the baseball world works. So, I don't know where this goes, and I'm not sure what Aaron Boone can do or not do to get this team out of its malaise. It's not a good offensive team. It's not a good base running team. It's not a good defensive team, and they have issues with their rotation that people could see coming because, of course, Kluber and Herman and Tyone had pitched hardly at all last year combined. Kluber already is out. Tyone has been inconsistent. Herman had a bad day Sunday, but otherwise has been pretty good. Maybe they turn it around, but I'm having a hard time seeing it. And yes, like you guys out there, I am wondering what happens next.
So dark times in the Bronx, but we're going to change the mood here. We're going to go to the north side of Chicago, where it's a completely different vibe as the Cubs going into Sunday. We have not seen the Sunday night game yet as we record this, but they take the first two from the Cardinals. Ken, you were there on Saturday night, full capacity at Wrigley. What's the vibe like in Wrigleyville?
The vibe in Wrigleyville is very happy right now, as it often is when the Cubs are winning, and sometimes even when the Cubs are not winning due to the alcohol intake in Wrigleyville, which per capita is fairly high. Friday was one of the games of the year. The Cubs had this amazing comeback, Rizzo 14-pitch at bat that ended in a home run. It was the symbolic reopening of the city, and it was just an electric atmosphere all weekend long with the Cardinals in town. That's the big rivalry, and it just really was such a welcome environment to be back in. And that's one of my favorite places in baseball. Might be my favorite, actually. And it was just like you remembered it this weekend. Now, I want to talk about each team because these are two teams going in opposite directions, as they say. And yes, we're taping this before Sunday night's game, but I don't know that any of the trends will necessarily change. Let's start with the Cardinals because they're the team with the bigger problems right now. And I said this on the air on Saturday night. This is a rotation that is a house of cards, and it is crumbling. And we know about the pitchers they have on the injured list. It's Flaherty, it's Michaelis, it's Kim, and Kim is going to come back soon. But the pitchers that are currently in the rotation, the ones who were or are stalwarts, they're at least guys who are questionable too. Now, Adam Wainwright's been great all year. He turns 40 on August 30th. Can you expect him to be great all year? Maybe. He's a special guy, but I don't know that you can count on it. John Gant, he's had peripherals that would suggest a lot of batted ball luck all year long. He's had the highest walk rate in the majors, and then he walked the house on Saturday night. He's a question mark. Carlos Martinez pitched Sunday. If he was good, great, but you can't count on him being good all the time. And then you've got Johan Oviedo. He's the rookie. There's not much else they can turn to. People have asked about the kid, the prospect, Matthew Liberatore, who was so good in the Olympic qualifier, and he pitched well Saturday night in his return to AAA. But my gosh, he's barely pitched above A ball. You don't want to put him in the savior role. And then you say, well, what about a trade? You can make a trade right now, but you pay dearly because the prices are always higher at this point of the trading cycle when there's so much time left, when the sellers can basically name their price. If they get it, they get it. If they don't, just hold and hold and hold. So the Cardinals are in trouble, is what I'm trying to say here. And I don't see an easy way out for them. Now, on the other side, the Cubs. One of the great surprises of the season, not a surprise along the lines of the Giants or even the Red Sox, but remember, this was a team that started off by trading Yu Darvish in December. That's what they did. That's what they signaled, that it was going to be kind of a transition year. And certainly we all expected them to sell at the deadline. And the potential free agents include Rizzo and Baez and Bryant and Kimbrel and Peterson and on and on. This was going to be a team that was going to be transitioning. It was going to be a team that was going to get younger. And that was the way it was going to be. Maybe they would keep a couple of those guys. Maybe not. All right. Well, here you are. They are one of the best teams in the National League. If they had Yu Darvish, they might be the best team in the National League, but they don't. And now you have to look at it completely differently. If your Cubs ownership and your general manager, I'm sorry, president of baseball operations, Jed Hoyer, and you've got to look at it, at least right now, and we're 6 weeks out from the deadline, in buy mode, because your team is really good. Your bullpen is incredibly good, to the surprise of so many people. And your offense has finally revived, what they've been waiting for a few years now. So what they need is a starting pitcher. Whether they can get one or not in the coming weeks will be decided. But don't talk to me about selling at this point. The chance to win is too precious. Comes along too rarely. It's not something you can take for granted. So yes, they need to buy. And yeah, I know Yu Darvish was traded for financial reasons, but guess what? We're back at full capacity at Wrigley Field sooner than they expected. They're making money again sooner than they expected. So it's my anticipation and expectation that they will buy, because basically you'd be looking at a revolt in Wrigleyville if that wasn't the case. Really interesting to see what happens with this team in the weeks ahead. Now, I'm not suggesting, as Chris Bryant actually did this weekend, that they can sign all of these guys back. That's probably not realistic. But you certainly can keep a few of them. And then you make the others qualifying offers. Bryant and Kimbrel, I'm assuming they will not be re-signed. And I'm assuming Baez and Rizzo will, just for the sake of discussion. You make Bryant and Kimbrel the qualifying offers. They reject. You take the draft picks. And you're accomplishing two things at once. You're competing this year, or you would have competed this year at that point. And you're still getting younger because you're collecting draft picks, increasing the size of your draft pool, and looking forward in that way. So the Cubs season has taken a turn for the better. Barring an outright collapse, I don't expect them to sell.
If only they could trade for Yu Darvish, then they'd be all set, right?
Imagine. Wouldn't that be something, Tim?
Send it, just reset. Just turn it back. Same trade in reverse. All right. Great times in Chicago, tough times in New York. Let's get on to the mailbag.
Hey, this is Ken. I'm not available right now. Please leave a voicemail.
If you want to get involved next week with the mailbag, you can call us or email us. The voicemail line is 646-543-7072. The email is tabaseballshow@gmail.com. We're going to start with the voicemail because this first one from Phil in Chicago goes right with what you were just saying, Ken.
Hi, Ken. Thanks for all that you do. My name is Phil, and my question is regarding the Chicago Cubs. Is there any possible chance that Chris Bryant would ever take a quote-unquote hometown discount to stay with the Cubs? If not, is he still a foregone conclusion to leave the Cubs?
Phil, I wouldn't call it a foregone conclusion, but I certainly would expect that it is more likely he leaves than stays. And you ask about a hometown discount, and it always sounds good. Hey, show loyalty to your team. They're the guys who drafted you. You've made your name here. All true. At the same time, let's not forget the Chris Bryant saga with the Cubs. The service time manipulation that kept him in the minors longer and gave the team an extra year of club control. Well, that year of club control turned out to be a year that the Cubs thought they didn't want when Bryant had a bad year in 2020. And now, well, we're happy we have him. You're right. You're happy you have him. He might be the National League MVP. And then the other factor here is that they have at least made him overtures. I don't know about formal offers. I don't know exactly what went down. And there's been reports of $200 million offers, denials of $200 million offers. But it's safe to assume they've discussed this. It has not gone to the point where a deal has been nearly completed or completed. Chris Bryant's agent is Scott Boras. not always, but usually, Scott Boras wants for his clients the highest possible market value. And that's established in free agency, not through an extension. So if you put all of these factors together, I just don't see Bryant taking a hometown discount. And I don't know that he should. In fact, I don't think he should. The service time manipulation, I'm not saying he should carry that grudge, but it's a factor. It happened. Boras, his style, his preferences, that's a fact. And Chris Bryant's incredible performance this year. Five different positions. He's played wherever his team has needed him to play. He's producing offensively the way he has in the past. And the president of baseball operations, Jed Hoyer, made a point over the weekend when he was asked about Bryant being willing to play all those positions. And Hoyer said, it's not 2016. It's not his second year in the big leagues when he was on a veteran team where he really couldn't say anything. If Chris Bryant wanted to object, he could object and say, I want to play third base. It's my free agent year. He hasn't done that. And it's been all the more impressive. So no, I don't expect a hometown discount. And no, I do not expect him to stay with the Cubs.
I mean, service time manipulation may go away after the next CBA, but looking back on the times that it's occurred and the big ones like Chris Bryant, and to me, like, he certainly doesn't owe them anything after that. And he's certainly given the championship as well. Looking for an assist with your credit card, but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this?
A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. Terms and restrictions apply.
To the email next, Ken, and this one from Tim in Calgary. He gave me the option to shorten this, which is good because he's attacking the sticky substances from all different angles. But I'll shorten it up a little.
All right, let's hear it.
He says, is it truly policeable? Part one. Is it as rampant as people have rumored it is? Part two. And then is the proposed punishment, he says several days without pay, enough for deterrent? I don't know if anything like that is locked in at this point. The last thing, which maybe is interesting here too, does this make some guys playable? Because if they don't have the, and I think they'll have some sort of substance, but we've seen guys get wild if they don't have any kind of stickiness and they can be dangerous. So he says, does this make some guys unplayable?
Okay, I'll try to take them one at a time. Is it truly policeable? Yes, it is policeable. If the powers that be decide, as they have decided, to finally enforce the rules on the book, which strictly prohibit the use of illegal foreign substances on baseballs by pitchers. It's not allowed. And what's going to happen now, the way it's going to be policed, is that the umpires, finally, are going to be empowered to check pitchers and make decisions based on what they see. There will be, as I reported Sunday, at least two checks of a starting pitcher per game, checks of every reliever. These will occur after innings as to not slow down the game. If an umpire notices that, in his view, a player or pitcher is using a foreign substance, he can check him in the middle of an inning, and it would result in an ejection, and they would confiscate his equipment or whatever it needs to be confiscated and give it over to the league. To the second question, is this rampant? You bet it's rampant. And I go back to November because there are a couple of reporters who have been on this really for quite some time. One is Buster Olney of ESPN.com, and the other is our own Eno Saris. And Eno, frankly, in my view, I might be a little biased, has been on it even more pointedly than Buster. And Eno wrote in November, the lead of his article, your favorite pitcher probably is cheating. And at the time, I don't recall if he gave a percentage or not, but it is generally thought throughout the game, not just by people like Eno, but people in the game, working for teams, players, that it's a huge percentage, 70, 80, 90%, whatever the case might be. So yes, it's rampant. There's not a question about that. The proposed punishment without pay, I don't believe that will fly. I don't even know that it's been proposed. Players generally do not have their pay withheld for on-field infractions like this. Pineda didn't when he had his issue. It's different with certain other forms of discipline, but I would expect that there will be a punishment attached to this, probably a 10-game suspension the way it's been in the past. If it's without pay, I will guarantee the first such suspension would result in a grievance from the union, and we'd have to fight that fight. Well, they'd have to fight that fight. I wouldn't be involved. I don't really care. But that would be their fight. Now, the playable question, I'm not quite sure I'm totally understanding it, but I think what you're saying, Tim, is that some pitchers might not be able to pitch because they need some kind of substance. Now, rosin will still be allowed. What they're trying to attack here are these advanced substances like spider tack and these things that for some reason enable you to increase your spin rates, increase your movement, and make you a better pitcher than you should be under more ordinary circumstances. It's not unlike in that regard the steroid situation. Players who were average became good by using steroids. Players who were good became great. And certain players who were great became immortal. I'm not saying it's exactly the same analogy. It's not. Steroids have a health risk and that component that is completely unlike what's going on here. In fact, you could argue, and pitchers will argue to some degree, that it's a health risk not to use the substances for the sake of controlling the pitches. But at the same time, there are going to be effects of this. And I don't know exactly how it's going to play out. No one knows that. But if we see a little bit of normalizing in spin rates, in movement, presumably you'll see more offense, and presumably pitchers will figure out ways to grip the ball. And listen, there are issues with the ball. I cannot understand why they have not yet produced a tacky ball like the one they use in Japan. It's mind-boggling to me that this sport can't handle this, but that's where we are.
The chemists who are working on the sticky stuff need to be working on the baseball. That's basically what we need.
Maybe that's it, yeah.
All right, back to email. This one's from Ryan Lohr, and there's a couple questions on this topic. Do you think the Nationals trade Max Scherzer, and what does a return look like?
I don't know that they will. They're going to try to compete to the very end. That's been the nature of their organization. They have not been an organization that, in recent times, if ever, has sold at the deadline. And Max Scherzer is a unique case. Now, right now, the way the Nationals are playing, and I know they had a good day Sunday, but I don't see them as a serious contender. At the same time, we're 6 weeks away from the deadline. They've still got every chance to prove that they are. But let's assume, for the sake of this discussion, that they are not. In my view, at that point, they absolutely should trade Max Scherzer. Their farm system is depleted. Their major league club is not where they want it to be. Depth is not there. And Scherzer, as I've said before, would be the bell of the ball at the deadline. He'd be the guy that everybody wants. Yes, he has a no-trade clause, and that will enable him to effectively choose where he wants to go. And that does present some complications. But the Nationals absolutely should do it. And if you're a Nats fan, you might say, well, whoa, this is our guy. He became or will be a Hall of Famer in our uniform. This was maybe the best free agent contract signed in recent memory in terms of the value the player gave you in return. All of that is true. But you have to look at the health of the organization. And you might say, if you're a Nats fan, well, wait, we're going to re-sign him. We're going to keep him. Not so fast. Max Scherzer is going to be a free agent. He's not giving the Nationals a hometown discount necessarily. He's going to want to explore the market, my hunch is. And by trading him, you could always re-sign him. Remember, when the Yankees traded Chapman in 2016 to the Cubs, what did they do that offseason? They re-signed him. It doesn't always happen that way. In fact, it's the exception. It's not the rule. But the Nationals could have every chance to do that. If you bring back Scherzer in that fashion, it's not going to be a qualifying offer situation because once a player is traded, he's no longer eligible for a qualifying offer. You're not going to lose a draft pick. It's a question of money. And they can still do that and have it both ways. Get the players back for Scherzer, and get him back as well if they are the high bidder. So, in my opinion, this is not even that close, and you kind of have to remove the emotion from it, because if you keep him, you still might lose him as a free agent. There's no guarantee. So why keep a player for 2 months in a losing cause when you can get something for him and still be in really the same circumstance come the offseason?
Well, one fan base that would love to get their hands on Scherzer, we already talked about a little bit. Here's Jack from Illinois.
Hey, this is Jack from Illinois. I'm a huge Cardinal fan. And as we know, the Cardinals are looking up at the Brewers and Cubs right now in the NL Central standings. I, for one, think that the Cardinals are in big need for a good starting pitcher, especially with Flaherty down after the All-Star break. I think that a Scherzer trade would be ideal for St. Louis, given he's a St. Louis kid, and I think that we could definitely pull off a trade, especially with Gorman still being in our farm system. And I think that if he would have been offered the Arenado trade, no one would have blinked an eye. So I think that a trade for him and Scherzer straight up would be really good, and I want to know what you think. And thanks a lot.
All right, Jack, let's start with Nolan Gorman, who you referenced there. I don't think you want to trade him. 2 home runs Friday night, and I know this was after you sent your voicemail, and 3 on Saturday night. That is way too high a price to pay for a rental. Now, he's a third baseman. He's playing some second base this year. There's not an obvious spot for him, certainly with Arenado there, but you could play Edmund in the outfield. You're just not trading that guy for a rental. You might have traded him, I guess, in an Arenado trade if the financial aspects have been different, but the Cardinals got away without doing it there for a guy under long-term control. Why would you want to do it for a rental? No way. But to your point, Jack, you're absolutely right. This is the perfect fit. And this is a guy who will change a franchise for those 2 months that he is with them. Would he approve St. Louis? I assume because he is from St. Louis, yes, he would approve St. Louis, provided they were close enough in the race and he didn't have an option like, say, the Dodgers or the Padres, a team he felt maybe had a better chance to win the World Series. So that's one obstacle. And finances might be an obstacle, too, because the Cardinals, remember, they did make the Arenado trade. That was their big move of the year. And their payroll right now, according to Fangraphs, is at about $168 million. That's the highest in club history. Do they want to go over? Should they go over? Well, I can spend their money easily. I was in St. Louis a few weeks ago, and I saw what is happening at Ballpark Village, that little development that they've had or built around the ballpark. It is a complete cash cow. But will they do it? I don't know. So, yes, if this continues with the Cardinals, and certainly they're going to have rotation issues, I would expect they at least make that phone call. Whether they can do it, want to do it, that remains to be seen.
John in Lexington is a Pirates fan, and he is a realistic Pirates fan. He says the Pirates will indeed be sellers at the trade deadline. What type of return could they expect for Adam Frazier and Richard Rodriguez, and what suitors do you anticipate making runs at those players?
Well, let's start with Frazier. He's a good player, and he's making $4.3 million this year. Then he's eligible for arbitration 1 more year. So he has that additional year of control, which, if you can trade him, would presumably ensure that they get better prospects. And this is a prospect-type trade for the Pirates. That's what they're going to want. Now, entering Sunday, Adam Frazier was 4th in the league in batting average, .333, behind Castellanos, Winkler, and Vladimir Guerrero Jr. He had the 4th lowest strikeout rate in the majors, and the question arises from the fact that he had the 7th highest batting average on balls in play, which means that he's been a little bit lucky. That's okay. He's still a good player. He's still a guy that you want on your team. The problem with him, I think, is going to be finding the right fit. There aren't obvious fits for a second baseman, and yes, I know he can play left field as well and has in the past. Maybe the Giants, but they've got LaStella coming back. Maybe the Yankees, but they've got Voit coming back, so DJ LeMay, who will play second. Maybe the Indians, if they're fed up with Cesar Hernandez. But for the most part, that's the problem with trading position players at the deadline. It has to be almost a perfect fit. And maybe they can find a team that would use Frazier kind of all over the field. I could see that, and they can get prospects for him in that regard. Could happen. Richard Rodriguez, a more classic trade piece because relief pitchers are always in demand at the deadline. He's got a 1.93 ERA going into Sunday, 25 and a third innings, 20-3 strikeout to walk ratio. All the numbers are pretty good. Making $1.7 million this year, has 2 years remaining under club control. So the Pirates are going to want a good package for him, and rightly so. So yes, I would expect the Pirates are going to continue doing what they've done, which is trading guys who are starting to make money. My question for the Pirates is going to be the same as it's been for the last couple of years. When does it shift the other way? When do you start keeping players and start really building something? It's a fair question at some point, but I don't see them as being at that point yet.
You would hope that they will want to build something eventually around Ke'Bryan Hayes. I mentioned Ke'Bryan Hayes at the top of the show. Ken, Noah Castro for one, not impressed with the base running.
Ken, this is Noah Castro from outside of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Continue to enjoy your podcast with Ken every Monday. So after the unfortunate base running blunder last night by Ke'Bryan Hayes, whose responsibility do you believe it is in regards to base running when it comes to the fundamentals? Is it an overall coach's aspect, like each coach needs to take a part in their role? And how much work is really done on this over the regular season in comparison to, you know, PIFP training in spring training?
Good question, Noah. And I assume you're not just referring to the Ke'Bryan Hayes play, because that's just a bonehead mistake. They don't practice touching the bases in spring training. It's a little bit beyond Little League at this point. But the question you raise is actually something that is kind of at the heart of a debate going on within the game right now, particularly with the veteran scouts and executives and even some former players who watch what is going on a daily basis and are appalled, absolutely appalled by what they see. And just stick to the base running, because there's a lot that they're appalled by, but the base running is one aspect of this. And the problem in the view of these baseball people is that the emphasis in instruction right now is on power. Power hitting, hitting the ball over the fence, power pitching, even if you don't necessarily know where it's going. And those are the things that get players noticed, get them signed as amateurs. It's what teams emphasize, it's what they're looking at, and it's at the expense, in the view of these people, and I happen to agree with them, of the fundamentals of the game and the instruction that is supposed to take place. I work with Bill Ripken at MLB Network, and he did a breakdown last week on field vision, which is that cool 3D-ish view of the field you get of the players looking like computerized figures. And you can see exactly where they're moving on a particular play. And he pointed out how the Cardinals on one play, and there might have been another team on another, just absolutely did not know where to go on a cutoff and relay. Certain players on the field did not know where to go. And this is the kind of thing that's getting lost. And the games are sloppy. And that you can see base running mistakes every day. Is it practiced regularly? Not really. But at the same time, these are players who should know this also. And it's not stuff that should necessarily have to be reinforced, but you know what? It does need to be reinforced, because it's not being taught, in my view, the way it once was. And that's a problem. It makes the game less aesthetically pleasing. It is actually a competitive disadvantage for the teams that don't know what they're doing on the bases or in the field or in any regard of the game that features certain subtleties. And you've seen a few writers been railing about this lately. Kevin Kernan is one. He used to be with the New York Post. Bob Nightingale had a story quoting Brian Price in USA Today on Sunday, in which Brian said he was fed up with the way the game was going. These are not uncommon sentiments. These are sentiments I basically hear every single day. And at some point, the game has to recalibrate and focus more on those fundamentals to get back to where we should be as a sport.
Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets, and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.
When you get injured, you don't want to wait for answers and options. That's why it may be time to explore the Nano Experience, a revolutionary treatment option designed to help active people get back to the lifestyles they love. Nanotechnology allows surgeons to see inside even the smallest joints and treat orthopedic conditions with a tiny camera and other nano instrumentation, all through a barely there poke hole incision. Wherever you've experienced an injury, whether it be a foot and ankle, hand and wrist, shoulder and elbow, knee or hip, nanoarthroscopy can be used to diagnose and treat your condition in an extremely, minimally invasive way. Don't wait to learn about the revolutionary Nano Experience and how it could help you or someone you know after an injury. Visit arthrex.info/theathletic. This is not medical advice and is not meant to be a substitute for advice from your physician. Talk with your physician about your health condition, potential surgical risks, and whether Arthrex products are right for you. Postoperative management is patient-specific and dependent upon your physician's assessment. Individual results will vary.
Yeah, great point. All right, we've reached the Hall of Fame section of the podcast, which has become a weekly event, and we love it. This one's via voicemail.
Hi, Ken. This is Kevin Pacelli from Milford, Connecticut. I just had a question regarding what I'm going to get ahead of the curve and call the sticky ball era, the era of pitching and the general run environment, which we're currently living in right now. I know that it is too hard to predict this far out. We're still, you know, ways away from understanding the full fallout of this thing. But I was just wondering what your thoughts might be on how some of this all may play out in future Hall of Fame considerations. Do you think it's a situation like in the steroid era where only players confirmed to be users have an asterisk next to their name? Or do you see a situation in which all pitching stats from this era have a huge asterisk next to their name? Thank you so much, and thanks for doing what you guys do.
Kevin, you're thinking ahead, and I love it. And I'm not sure the answer to your question, though. And it's certainly something that has me thinking. And I'll give you a few thoughts as they kind of come into my head. I don't know that it will be treated the same as the steroid era. And it kind of all needs to play out still. We need to see if the spin rates decline with certain pitchers, if certain pitchers suddenly become ineffective, if certain pitchers are suspended, what the league trends are. All of these things would factor into this discussion, which of course will not take place for at least 5 years with any of these pitchers because they're still all active. And you don't get to be eligible for the Hall until after you're retired for 5 years. Now, if we see in certain Hall of Fame candidates a precipitous decline in the coming weeks and seasons, then you might have his candidacy come more into question. If you see a Hall of Fame candidate who gets suspended after the enforcement becomes stricter, you might have a different question and people changing their opinion. But the problem is largely the same problem as we have with candidates from the steroid era, and it's that you don't know who exactly was doing what and to what extent. And that's my problem as a voter regarding players in the steroid era. I don't know. Now, some players, we certainly have more evidence than others. Some were suspended. Okay, we know. Others, like Bonds and Clemens, weren't suspended, but there's certainly ample evidence. And then there are others who eventually made it to the Hall. I'm not going to name names, but there are players in the Hall, I feel relatively certain, that use performance-enhancing drugs. So how do you distinguish? That's a problem that certainly exists with players in that category, and it might exist as well in players in this category. But I would say, Kevin, that this all needs to play out a little bit more still before we really have any basis for an opinion.
All right, one more Hall of Fame question. This one comes from Vinny, more specific to a player.
Vinny from Long Island. Guys, big fan of the show. Just curious, in the case of Johan Santana falling off the Hall of Fame ballot, was it a case of all he had to do was win another Cy Young and maybe he would have had more of a serious case, because it seems like he just got forgotten about because of his lack of wins. But as we're going to see moving forward, there's not going to be many pitchers that get 200 wins, let alone 300 wins. So, all right, guys, thank you for your time.
Vinny, that's fair, and that's certainly true. We're going to need to reassess based on workloads and the way pitchers are being used today, starters, as opposed to the way they were used in the future. Santana fell off the ballot, as you said, after 1 year in 2018, got only 2.4% of the vote. And part of his problem that year was the crowded ballot. The ballot was very crowded then, and it hurt guys like him. They did not get as much consideration as they might have if things had been a little bit looser. But Santana's real problem, and I love this guy as a pitcher, I loved watching him, but his real problem as a candidate is that his career just wasn't long enough. He played 12 seasons, won two Cy Youngs during that time, but he also had two of those seasons with fewer than 100 innings each. Now, I went back and read Jay Jaffe's great work on Fangraphs and what he said about Santana. Jay is the leading Hall of Fame expert, really, in the country, and he basically made the case that guys like Santana occasionally make it. Sandy Koufax was one. Dizzy Dean was another. But those players have outsized impacts on their team. They pitch their teams to at least one championship, and you can't fault Santana for the fact he didn't. But that is what kind of distinguished them. Now, if Santana was to be considered again, say, by a veterans committee, one thing that they would look at is that no enshrined starting pitcher has fewer than his 139 wins. I don't know that that matters as much anymore. I get that, and I agree with that. Also, pitched barely 2,000 innings, just over 2,000, and only Dizzy Dean fewer innings as a starter in the Hall. So he had a short peak. It was 5 years, maybe a stretch at the seven, but it wasn't that sustained excellence that we generally look for in our Hall of Fame candidates, and he didn't have that World Series championship that might have vaulted him to a level where we see him similarly to Koufax and Dizzy Dean. That's what happened. As always with Hall of Fame conversations, it doesn't mean that Johan Santana was anything less than a great pitcher. He was a great pitcher, but the Hall of Fame is a different animal.
Great questions again this week. As always, if you want to get involved next week, you can use the voicemail line or email. Call 646-543-7072. The email is tabaseballshow@gmail.com. Looking ahead to next weekend, Ken, where are you going to be?
I am in Atlanta for the Cardinals and Braves, two teams that are curious and curiouser. And looking forward to seeing exactly where they stand a week from now, because it hasn't been good so far, or at least lately.
You feel like Atlanta, the better chance to turn things around than St. Louis?
I do, but remember, they're going to be without Ozuna maybe the whole year. And their starting pitching really hasn't clicked the way you would think. And their bullpen has been unsettled as well. So I am curious to see where they go, because I still like them a whole lot. I still think they're really good.
All right, stay locked into the Athletic Baseball Show all week long. Coming up on Tuesday, a little Olympic flair. Todd Frazier joining Jason Stark and Doug Glanville to talk about the dramatic qualification for the Olympics. Todd, a big part of that. Then on Thursday, it's Hunter Pence and Grant Brisby. Friday, Derek Van Riper and Keith Law, always finishing out the week. If you want to read all the great writing of all those different people, plus all the other sports, we got hockey playoffs going on right now, NBA playoffs going on right now. It's a great time to become a subscriber to The Athletic, and you can do it for just $3.99 a month if you go to theathletic.com/baseballshow. Ken, you have a great week.
You too, Tim. Thank you.
All right, and thanks to everybody else out there for listening. You have a great week as well.